The Foundation for Ancient Research and Mormon Studies presents the Pearl of Great Price Lecture Series, given by Dr. Hugh Nibley. Today's lecture is entitled, The Council According to the Shabako Stone.
Columbus was at dinner with some dignitaries, and it was after his first voyage to America, and they somewhat said it wasn't such a great thing after all. The ship did it easily enough. Anybody could have done it. Later on, Columbus didn't say anything, but later on he said, can any of you here stand and make an egg stand on end? Can you stand an egg on end? Well, they tried it. Everybody tried it. They all tried putting the egg on end. Couldn't do it at all. Columbus took the egg and gave it a light tap and stood it on its end. Someone said, well, of course, anybody can do it that way. Yes, he said, yes, and anybody can do it once someone shows them how it's done. See, there was nothing said about the egg. The egg couldn't be cooked or that the shell had to be unbroken or anything like that. Just could you make the egg stand up? But after you, the point was with Columbus, after somebody's done it, it's the easiest thing in the world and no great show at all when it's been done. It's the same way. They were absolutely helpless. They floundered around until Professor Breasted, who was very much interested in the Book of Mormon, incidentally. His wife, whom I knew very well, we used to bicycle together in Claremont. She lived next door, and in those days people didn't ride bikes much, and so we used to wheel around the place. And that was after Breasted had died. He'd retired there. But it used to bug him. He intended, she said, to get rid of the problem once for all. He liked a lot of Mormons, and he says the best thing to do is just show in a brief, a half hour or 20 minutes, you can show where this is wrong and that's wrong. There'd necessarily be some glaring contradictions in it. So he set to work and never a peep. It just, nothing came of it. Well, anyway, he did the great work, and after that, everybody could set the egg on end. He gave it this rave notice, as I say, which you'll read in the Monist, the first philosopher. And then Ehrman came along in 1909 and gave it the name Shabako. That's Shabako, some comes from Ehrman at Berlin. He called it the Shabako text because it was by King Shabako. And the great study of it is by Seta, 1929. Others have come out since. But this is basic. This is the one that first brought it out, and it's good. But he says Shabako was just the man. He believed that Shabako was the founder of the dynasty. Shabako was an extremely religious man, and he'd come up from the south, and he wanted to establish his dynasty there, and he was just the man to do this, the founder of the dynasty, a great archaeizer. He goes right back to the beginning of things, digging up all the records he can. Lots of pharaohs practiced that, were interested in the archaic documents and tried to restore things, especially in the 22nd and the 25th and 26th dynasties, and this was the 25th dynasty when it really happened. Under the Sheshem kids, the 26th dynasty, they went back to the earliest days and renewed everything. And they thought, well, this is a copy from that. No, it is a faithful copy, not a reproduction, not an attempt to imitate anything. But Seta believes that Shabako was just the man to give us this text. Each new capital, every time you founded a new dynasty, they would do the same thing, renew the theology, give a new version of the creation story. It was done at Heliopolis, then Menes did it at Memphis, that's this text here, then Amenemes did it in the Middle Kingdom at Dashur, then Amenos the Fourth, Ikhotun, did it at El Amarna, then the Muslims did it at Cairo, always with a new center and the new theology, but they always follow along the same line. But this is what he wanted to do. I said he was going to renew it, so he went back to the old temple that was built for the first to celebrate the founding of the first dynasty in Egypt, beginning of civilization, 3200 BC. And it was very old then, he finds out. Epigraphically, orthographically, vocabulary, and syntax all put it before the pyramid text, and the pyramid text, the oldest book in the world. They go back, they're all before 2000. But they go way back right to the pyramids. The pyramid texts are found under the pyramids, written on the walls, beautifully carved and so forth. But they're very old. They go back to 2800, 2900 BC. And this is older than that, the grammar. As I say, this is proved epigraphically. What do you mean by epigraphically? By the way it's carved on the rock, the order, the columns, the way they're divided and so forth, it's the quaint, the old-fashioned way. They never did it later on. It was never used after, say, the 11th dynasty, so it puts it very old. Then orthographically, the way they spelled things, they used the old archaic spellings, very, very quaint spellings. Well, those of you who are in English know the difference between Middle English and West Saxon and Northumbrian and modern and medieval, medieval is Middle English. But you recognize immediately what particular period it came from, though they'll be using the same words. It was the same thing here. And the syntax, that's the order in which the words occur. That is peculiar to the times. And everything puts it before the pyramid text, so very, very old. The right side, this is the, what we're showing here is the left side first. The left side is the drama, and the right side is the theological discourse. Is the temple drama. Now, it's the same drama, incidentally, because we read that from Zabkar, as we read that that piece the last time. This carries right on, he says, into the Old Testament and the New Testament. You'll find everything is very familiar here, and this caused everybody to pause, because, after all, what are these people doing with the Bible? Way back Shabbat, the first person to look at this, Shabbat, was stunned by, in other texts especially, by close resemblances to the Bible in the Pedocerus. In the 1920s, the Pedocerus text is a classical example of that. It has long passages from the Psalms, the Proverbs in it, and you'll find Old Testament passages, and you'll find New Testament passages in work written 300-400 B.C. Well, this shouldn't be, you see. So they would always soft-pedal it, and they always skipped around it. It's only within the last 10 years that they've said, all right, if it looks like an elephant, call it an elephant. This has been staring us in the face all these years, and we haven't dared to say. Everybody was blushing, no one would dare mention it and so forth. Now, all of a sudden, within the last 3 or 4 years, that half a dozen articles or big studies have come forth showing that the wisdom literature of the Egyptians, Amenemes, as Ehrman showed once, he was ashamed of it, he kept it covered up, he never mentioned the fact, it was his greatest discovery. The wisdom of Amenemes is the wisdom of Solomon, it's the same thing. And word for word passages. Well, this really stunned him, so Ehrman tried to cover it up. That would never do. That's not the evolutionary development of things. But today it's being recognized. As my old Professor Popper used to say, see, the story as the rabbis tell, when the animals came to Adam, he was naming them, and the Lord said, what are you going to call this one? He said, I'm going to call it an elephant. Well, why an elephant? Because it looks like an elephant, he said. So Professor Popper used to say, if it looks like an elephant, call it an elephant. Sometimes you'll hesitate and say, no, it can't possibly mean why. If that's what it looks like, try that first. Take a chance here. Well, we have the theology, and the left side is the myths of Horus and Seth and the learned discourse in the drama. The oldest parts, they're very old parts, they are the dialogues of the gods here. They're preserved in archaic form, like a Greek chorus. Now, a Greek plays, most of the plays come from Athens, they do. They're in the Ionic dialect, that's Athenian. But the choruses are in Doric. They're in the old Doric or Aeolic. But Doric, that's the older language, and the chorus will come on with this archaic Doric with the long ahs and so forth, because they're preserving the original text. It's the same way here. There's obviously two texts. There's a rather free commentary, which is much newer, though it's far older than anything else. But then what they're commenting on is the Ur text, the text that goes right back to the beginning. The rest was more up to date, but very late. The speeches of the Godhead are the remains, Zeta says, of a prehistoric book. They were kept in a book. The book, of course, was long lost. It was copied from this. Remember, he tells us here that he had it copied from a leather roll that was found in the cornerstone, practically, like the cornerstone of the Nauvoo house, when they were renovating the White Temple, the first temple in United Egypt, the one that began the kingdom and so forth. They found this document, and he had it copied on stone. And that's why we have it today. But one of the reasons we've been so long getting it out is that it was so hard to read. And the reason it was so hard to read mostly was that it was in a dark hall in the British Museum and they'd never take it out so people could look at it. That's so absolutely typical. The great Richard Lawrence, who discovered the Enoch texts, had to do all his work in the Bodleian Library. They wouldn't ever even let him take the text over to the window so he could read it better. He couldn't take it out of that damp, dark cell in the Bodleian Library, and that's why he had to work all his life. And since then, it has rotted away from age. They haven't taken any care of it at all. That's the way they do. Well, anyway, the speeches of the Godhead show that we had a very old book here. And they're treating the sagas in it, the stories of Osiris and Horus and Set, in dramatic form. It was to be presented on a very special occasion, of course, at the new year, at the founding of not only the empire, but the beginning of the world, the revival of things. In fact, Seta says it is exactly, very closely parallels the mystery plays of Easter and Christmas. They were put on in the Middle Ages, but much earlier than the Middle Ages, you'll find them all over the Middle East, the same plays. The complex on the top of the temple at Dendera, which is preserved, is what Dumas calls it, who did more work than anybody else on it. He says it's an Easter complex. It was to celebrate the rebirth of the god at the spring equinox, which is Easter. And then there was the other one, which was the new year, when the sun comes back, the birth of the sun. But it's to celebrate the cyclical rebirth, death and rebirth of all nature and all the rest. We get our friend Deb in here. And so it's for presentation on festive occasions. But it was secret. Not everybody. It was given to only elect people. Only those who were qualified or had recommends could see it. And it's in verse, incidentally. Just as it's been quite recently discovered that the whole of the pyramid of the Book of the Dead, that's one thing people have been reading for 100 years now, the Book of the Dead, you know. They suddenly discovered that it's in verse. That's how little we know about the vowels and the values here. And Seta, who is the one who made the definitive edition of this, also edited the Ramesseum text from the Ramesseum on the other side of the Nile, over on the west side in Thebes. The Ramesseum, which is another early prehistoric dramatic text, and you can match the two. See, this is very good. This was a text which was dramatized with the king. The king had to take the role. He was Adam. He was the lead. And they went through the whole thing, and they toured the whole length of the Nile. The king and the court would dramatize this, and were chosen for various parts, and on different occasions they could shift the actors around. So the idea of traveling troops of actors is very old. I mean, it goes right back to the beginning of time, and it goes back to the days of Cain. The traveling around, you still find them traveling with a donkey and a shadow theater. I have an Arabic book on the subject, very good. The traveling shadow theaters in the Middle East. It's from way back pre-war times when things were fairly stable. But it was the practice of somebody would travel around, a traveling troupe, and what they put on was a shadow theater, shadow show. And the theme was Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden in the fall. They go through all that sort of thing. People would all gather for it. It would be a big affair and so forth. They get some good pictures of it, as a matter of fact. Well, now, in this text, the actio, that's the drama. See, the word drama means to, drao means to do, to carry out visibly. The Latin word action, which is the actio, the action of the play. There's the action, one thing, and then there is the speech, the spoken word, which is the dialogue. And the action is clearly marked by stage directions. They're very short, very specific, as with the Ramesseum drama. And Ehrman thought the stage directions were commentary, but it turns out, no, they're not. They're directions on what's supposed to be going on here. And these are directed by the Hereheb, the Hereheb is the lectern priest, who directs the ordinances and takes charge. He's the man who is in charge of the operations. There are others there that, well, of course, people participate, of course, in it, but he directs the whole thing, and he, or somebody else, sometimes somebody else, would read off the lines describing the events that could not be presented visually. There are some things, you know. Should we recite the introduction to Henry V at this point? We'd waste a lot of time. But this is why is the play the oldest thing? Why is the play the thing so much older? And why? It's because, of course, it is the most amusing, the most entertaining, engrossing. It involves you more than anything else. It makes things clear, more clear than anything else. It's the best way of abbreviating. You don't have to go into long words. The play can be kept short and tell you a great deal. Oh, for a muse, a fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention. Princes to a kingdom for a stage, princes to act, and monarchs to behold the swelling scene. Then would the warlike Harry-like himself assume, we'll get to the right part pretty soon, assume the port of Mars, while at his heels leashed in like hounds should famine, sword, and fire crouch for employment. Now, but pardon, gentle Zal, the flat, unraised spirits that have dared upon this lowly scaffold to bring forth so great an object. Why do you dare to bring? Because the objects of plays, these are king plays. They have to do with king, well, he goes on and explains. Can this so great an object, can this cockpit hold the vasty fields of France? Or can we cram into this wooden O the very casks that did affright the air in Agincourt? Oh, pardon. But, he says, if a crooked finger, figure may attest in little place a million, just by the just a one, you can make a million by adding ciphers. The crooked figure may attest in little space a million. Admit us ciphers to this great account. We'll be the ciphers. We'll go on adding ciphers and make it a big thing, though it's a small thing. Admit us ciphers to this great account. Let us ciphers to this great account upon your imaginary forces work. On your imaginary forces work. Suppose within the girdle of these walls. Now you have to make the play. You see. Suppose within the girdle of these walls are now embraced. Word isn't embraced, is it? Two mighty monarchies, whose high uprear in the budding heads the perilous narrow ocean parts asunder. Piece out our imperfections with your thoughts. Into a thousand parts divide one man and make imaginary puissance. This man represents the army. You divide him into a thousand parts and you make an imaginary puissance, imaginary force, military force. Think when we speak of horses that you see them, when you talk of horses that you see them, printing their proud hoofs in the receiving earth. For 'tis your thoughts that now must deck our kings, carry them to and fro. Jumping o'er time. See, time, you've got to take care of time and space. Carry them to and fro, jumping o'er time, turning the accomplishment of many years into an hourglass. You have to do all that. Imagine the time being concentrated and so forth. And also the guise of the kings and their splendor, you have to contribute to that too. Into an hourglass, for the which supply admit me chorus to this history and so forth. Well, that's the idea. You have to do it. You have to enter it. You're involved. And you're committed to the play, and Shakespeare is great at getting us that way, isn't he? There's the play from Hamlet. Well, we won't go into that. This is getting off the track, isn't it? I'm going to finish this whole thing today. So it's clearly marked by these states, but here it is now. Well over 5,000 years ago, they're putting on a play, and it's a terrific play. The first time I went to the Hopis, it was Brother Virgil Bushman, who was the great missionary of the Hopis. He was born down there, we go. And he insisted, just after the war, insisted on taking me down there. The road was just a dirt trail. It was a terrible road at that time. They still were using ladders to get up to the mesas and so forth, and we went up there, and it was the 15th of March when they have their first dance. And it was bleak and windy, and you go up on the high mesa. It was at Ojota Villa, there in the plaza and houses. At dawn was this play going on. This tremendous drama was being played. Magnificent costumes they had. It was a cloud dance. And the rule is, you see, that you can never use anything bought. You can never use anything old or dirty. It had to be neat, beautiful, and made of native substance by yourself. Really something. And here they were doing this, and I started counting them. There were 52 dancers came in. 52 dancers in the oldest Greek chorus. There had to be that. It was 52 days of the week and so forth. And then the three, then the protagonist and the antagonist came in, and they started their dialogue. First the priest went around with the sack of meal and laid out the course that the chorus was to follow and so forth. And then a Greek play took place there. And after that, followed by a comedy with the koyemsi, the mudheads, clowning around and so forth. But it was the same motif. There was the altar in the center, as they have to be in a Greek play. Around it, of course, dance around. Nobody dances in that, because that is the konistra, the dust place where nothing lives. This is the bound, the moat between us and the other world, because in the center is an altar. And in every Greek play, the tragedy, the ghost appears out of the ground from there. And there they had the two trees. They have the two little evergreen trees, like Christmas trees, on either side of the altar in every place for where the Hopis have their festival in the 12 villages. And with the bahu feathers on them, with the spirit feathers tied in their prayers. And they have to, this takes you to the spirit world. And the ghost appears just as the ghost of Darius appears in the Persians out of the ground and so forth. So this stuff is very old. But who told these people to do this? Here, they're as poor as dirt. They were chased to the ends of the world, and now they're being brutally exploited by the cult people who are just strip mining their sacred places in an awful way. But the thing is, here they were by themselves going to all this trouble. There were only a couple of old people, a few old people, a couple of little kids on the houses. Because who wants to get up on a cold March morning at dawn and go through all, but they went through it with the greatest solemnity. Everything accurate. And the priests reciting their lines to each other and so forth. And they're very particular about any taking notes or writing anything. I just jogged one little thing down, and boy, they had it out of my hand in a second. I learned from then on. But I went to many of the dances after that, and some of them are so much, well, I went later down to Muinkopi. It was the time I took Brother Merlin Meyer down to the anthropologist. He'd never been to these Indians before. So I said, well, I'll go down all the time. We went down, and I took down a that very nice reproduction, 1912, of the Book of the Dead, all colors and everything. It's a beautiful reproduction that Budge got out, and I took it out, and there was a meeting of the kids, the Hopi kids. They met down at, it was at Tuba City, only it was across the road at the Hopi village at Muinkopi. And they recognized everything. They had, for example, the dancers had to have the two feathers. They had to have the cup bracelets. They had to have the tortoise shell. They had to have the coyote or the fox skin with the tail, as every Egyptian priest had to. They looked just like them. I mean, there was no difference at all. It's an amazing thing that goes on. Well, how old this stuff is? What's going on here? What have we been missing, you see? The thing is that it's still carried on. They still persist against tremendous odds, tremendous opposition. Peabody Corporation tried to get them all to move out to Los Angeles, and they offered them mobile homes if they would do that. Give up this thousands of years old culture. Resisted all they resisted the Spaniards, they resisted the Catholics, they resisted everybody. They all joined the church at once when the gospel was first introduced to them. Then in 1906, there was a big fuss in Congress, and the Mormons were forced to leave. And moreover, the Mormons had their farms all down there, as you know, at Muinkopi in the Dinebito Wash there. Dinebito Wash and the Muinkopi Wash is where the Mormon farms were, and you can still see the up along the benches, you can still see the poplar trees which mark the farms, but they were all forced to leave in 1906 because of the influence they had on the Indians. Well, that's another story, but it's very close to this one. What are these people up to? How do they know so much about these things? Now, the oldest parts are these dialogues, and the actio have these directions. The things are described that can't be staged, of course, by this lector priest who conducts the play. And this, he says, this is practically identical with the ancient mysteries of the Easter and Christmas celebrations. See, they're always at seasons. There are no dancing now. It won't be till the 15th of March, the first full moon in March. Mostly Easter, they start out. I'm always that one. That will give you goose flesh. No lights, no artificial lights. It has to be my moonlight. It has to be when the nearest full moon. There the Havawoodie comes out. That's really scary. The only sound, the only music allowed there, no drums, is the flute. A single sound. Of course, like the Greek. The earliest Greek play was just to the flute. Remember, the lyre is for, the melody is for the melodrama. For the solos, for the melodramatic stuff, you had the lyre and the string instruments, but for the old archaic stuff, it was just the flute. And it's eerie by full moonlight to see what. And then when the Havawoodie comes down and starts walking down the street with these tallest men, these giants, with their long rawhide whips whipping on either side, telling the people to get their distance, well, that's the Egyptian Nut. She comes out all in black, she emerges out of the kiva, and she's holding two bows in her hand like this. Of course, that's the symbol of a bow. And arrows, yes, she's blown two arrows in Neat. That's her sign, it says the two arrows. It's in here. We'll see the Lady Neat, the same thing, the two arrows. And she walks in a stately manner down, and everybody really keeps their distance. It's the Havawoodie, who is Neat, the woman who brought things first from the underworld. Well, anyway, the speeches are brief but few. Incidentally, here's another thing. There's no effort to follow chronological order here. Past events, if a past event must be brought up, they don't hesitate to use a flashback and show what happened in an earlier time. So don't try to construct it according to the rules of Aristotle here. And the speeches are brief and few, but they are the main thing. They are the prehistoric parts. It is an ancient, now quoting Seta here, it is an ancient, holy, piously guarded heritage, a secret ordinance, like the Easter mysteries. And which, of course, are, I mentioned the last time, Hector St. John Feasey's very interesting work on English Holy Week ceremonial, are very ancient, of course. Well, I would recommend that you read Augustine, not St. Augustine, but Augustine, who in 590 came as the first missionary to England. He was sent by Pope Gregory the Great. You notice the famous story about angels and angels? You all know that, you know? He saw these these little English children for sale in the marketplace in Rome. And he says, who are these? And I said, well, these are angels. And he says, they're not angels, they're angels. And he decided to send a mission up there, and he sent Augustine up there. Then Augustine reported on going down. We have his correspondence with Gregory. He says, look, you know what these people do? At the Easter time, they meet at these holy places, and they have their races and their festivals, and they build booths of green boughs, and they feast and hold celebrations, and along with the races and so forth, and they elect their king and queen and all the rest of it. And Gregory said, well, that's exactly what we do on Rome, in Rome at the same time of year, even in the same streets. Even in the streets we do that. We set long tables in the streets and have a feast for everybody at Easter. It's the time of rebirth, Christus Anesti, ec fenatu, they say everywhere. Christ has risen from the dead, everybody celebrate. And so let them go. Let them do anything they want. Let them build their green booths. Remember, in Israel, you had the sukkah, the sukkot, the booths. For the festival, you had to have a booth, because you had to, for the Passover, you had to go to Jerusalem, and nobody was allowed to celebrate the Passover within his gates. He had to make it as a pilgrim. So when you were there, you had to have some shelter. So we have the ordinances of the green booths, and we have them all over the world. Well, Gregory said, well, let them do it. Just sprinkle it with a little holy water, and there's no difference. I don't see any difference at all. And there wasn't, because the Romans had these, they were ancient long before that. Well, that was at the end of the 6th century. That you find it. And so they were doing their Easter business long before the Christianity ever got there. And it's the same thing here. He says, we're dealing with the very same type of thing, as we mentioned the last time, that other writer, Jarvis, that he, it goes right over into the Old Testament, the New Testament. Well, what before we turn it on? And this is the way Breasted begins his article. I say I put 4 or 5 copies on reserve. You can get it. It's short. Get a Xerox yourself, for that matter. He opens his article. During a sojourn in the British Museum, it was the writer's good fortune to subject to close scrutiny an ancient stone, the importance of which has hitherto been entirely unsuspected. Well, everybody suspected it might be important, but they couldn't make heads or tails of it. That's the trouble. It contains the oldest known philological explanation of the world, written 1,000 years before the first Greek philosopher was born. Well, he was wrong there. It was written 1,000 years before that, at least. You see, written 2,000 years, 3,000 years before the first philosopher was born. In other words, there were other people philosophizing, too. This is Neon. You would find this around. See, the archaic world has disappeared completely, and the marvelous thing is that this has been able to survive. He tells us how it happened to survive. Remember, making coffee and so forth. And for the first time, tangible support to the Greek tradition of the origin of their philosophy in the East. The Greeks attributed all their wisdom, but nobody would ever credit the Greeks when they said that. They said, we get everything we know from the Egyptians. Now the person who, Theodor Hopfner, was the man who spent his whole life searching, as a classical scholar, the Greek religion in the Egyptian religion as it's recorded by the Greek and the Roman writers, classical writers. But he always insisted, there was no connection between them, whatever. The Greeks insisted over and over and over again that, yes, they got that there. Plato studied in Heliopolis along with the rest of us, and Parmenides did and Thales did and so forth. No, no. German scholars always said no to everything like that. They had no proof that it wasn't so, but it just doesn't fit. It was too picturesque, too fantastic, and we don't allow things like that. They're not dignified. Well, now the stone itself is 3 feet by 4'7", like that, about 3 feet by 4'7". It's a black granite, and it's very heavy. But alas, alas, it has that square hole in the center of it, because it was used as another millstone. Of course, it couldn't, with that shape, it couldn't turn as an upper millstone, but it was used as a lower millstone. You can imagine how that would preserve an inscription to grind it and grind it and grind it and grind it for a few hundred years, like that. But it was very hard stone and so forth. And actually, the parts that ground up, you can't read, just very faint forms there. It is sadly damaged. And so faint, says Breasted, that either a squeeze or a photo was out of the question. They couldn't make an impression of it. A photo, the best thing to do would be make a rubbing of that. But they wouldn't let him do that. And paleographically, it's an exceedingly beautiful inscription. The signs are very much like those produced in modern hieroglyphic type. If this looks like a modern book, printed book like Gardner's Grammar or something, it really looked like that. They never changed the style. This is beautiful writing, way back there in the beginning, just as clear as ever. But it would be a lot easier to read, he says, outside of the dark hall. He says that in years to come, they might be able to bring some light in here and show them. They did, of course. They put light from various directions to bring out the contours and so forth, and then they could read it. Well, let's get to the text now and turn it on and see what we've got here. on the beginning. I guess we can turn some lights off. Or... Yes, now, here are the stage directions, you see. Ta, pel, pop, and pel. This one you see here, pel, means, refers to whatever we happen to be talking about. It always answers the question, who is this, or especially, what are you talking about? So, we introduce ourselves by saying, ta, remember we put his name, P-T-A-H, the opener, the beginner, ta, pen. This ta is the one we are talking about. Ta, pen, pel. Much, he is acclaimed, he is heralded in glory, because the notch is the granite, it's also the word for granite, incidentally. In the great name of Ta Chenin, and the abbreviation here shows how archaic it is, this usage. And we mentioned this before. Ta is in heaven now, it begins with Ta in his glory, and he wishes to convey or transmit the powers of heaven, the powers he possesses, to the earth. The same celestial order. Incidentally, what we're doing here is following the Terpander Nomos. Terpander, the 26th Olympic Games in 676 BC, Terpander introduced the musical. They introduced musical games, and Terpander won the prize. He won the prize then four times in succession at Delphi in the Pythian, at the Pythian contest. Notice these were at the holy centers. Delphi was the holiest of all. They were oracular centers, and Terpander introduced the musical element and what is called the Terpandrian Nomos, or the rule of Terpander. Going to write it, well, we can put it on blackboard here, illuminated. Won't bother me. Well, it's going to be an interesting effect, won't it? You know who Terpsichore is, the goddess of the dance and so forth. Terpander, yes, 676. Now, he introduced what's called the Terpandrian rule, or the Terpandrian nomos, which divides the thing, the whole, according to the ritual pattern, which divides epic song, namely, into the archae. You all know, an arche en ho hologos, the rule, the beginning, this is the foundation. You start up with Ta on his throne in the world above in timeless ages. And that's the arche, or the beginning. The middle part is called the omphalos. Now, the omphalos, same word as Latin, umbilicus. That is the navel, or the center of the thing, the main center around which everything is going to revolve. And the every ancient shrine, Delphi, for example, you can still see, some of you have been to Delphi, I'm sure, you can still see out in front of the temple, there's the umbilicus, shaped just like an umbilicus. Hole through it, this was the center of the world. This was the heliocentric point from which everything came. Every holy shrine had its umbilicus. A great deal has been written about the umbilicus, of course. The umbilicus. And this is the center. And then finally comes the sphragis, or the seal that seals everything up. Sphragis, Greek word for seal. And sure enough, this ends, the umbilicus here, you see, is where the upper millstone turned. It turned around here. And here was the square, and here to hold this in place. And so this is pretty well wiped out. But you notice the millstone only went to here, so this part was spared here, which gives us a little Garden of Eden romance in here. But the seal. Then on the final one, this is the other half, it ends as it began, but now his glory has been established on earth, naturally in Memphis. The whole purpose of this is to show that the king at Memphis, Shabako in this case, holds the same authority that was held by God and was handed down to man through Adam and through the heavenly council to the spirits and brought down to earth. That's what he's going to tell us about here. So we now proceed here, and the Ta is the main thing. But it's now Ta as Ta Chenin. Remember, the Ta Chenin means the uprising, the lifting up, the exalted, the rising of the land, the rising of the earth, the first pyramid, the first burial mound is the rising of resurrection. All that's together, along with the name Ta Chenin. His name is Ta Chenin, meaning the first person to put life upon the earth, Ta Chenin. So this is Ta coming down to earth, but it is very, Ta means earth, you see, Ta Chenin, and it's earthy. How are we going to transmit the powers and forces of the universe to this one little planet? This is the way we do it. Well, this is the land, this is the setting, this is the Ta, this is the land of the Resi of the north and of the Mehi of the south. And Pel, this is, you see, this is what it is. And Sam Pel, it is the joining place of the two glorious ones. These are thrones of glory. That was originally a sunburst coming out here. Of course, this is, it's very finely, very beautifully carved and so forth, But they were already conventionalized. It was the hill with the sun rays over it. So you had that this form like this and then like this. That's what this is, called the Ahi, the Chai, which means to arise in glory. It's the regular word using for coronation or crowning of a king. Enthronement was his Chai, his rising in glory, of course being compared with the sun. And of the north, notice he's wearing the, of the south, he's wearing the white king, of the white crown of the south, and north, the red crown of the north. There are always two crowns, always two thrones, even two graves for the king. Everything was double. Every ordinance was carried out four times, really. But there was the white and the red, and they were always mixed. We see they're mixed here. And Wetusel Yitim, he was who we got Atom. Now here is our friend Atom again, and who in turn, Meskera is the father or the begetter of the Pesach. The passage, writing on this passage here, that means the nine. You can see the nine, you count the nine. Everybody translates that as Ennead, but it isn't Ennead. It is as Sather says about this. Perhaps we are dealing here with the Ennead as no more consisting of nine members than that of Karnak, the writing of which has indeed no connection whatever anymore with the number nine. Anytime you want a large council, it's Ennead. See, the Egyptians, whenever you want a thing to be taken literally, they use it later on much more, but here we should have some examples of it here. Literally, you put a little stroke by it, signifying one item, one thing, and that's to be taken as it is. It's interesting how that's used later on. You have to use it with every word later on if it's taken. If you want it to be dual, you put two strokes by it. But three means any number after two, see, because you're not going to go on adding four and five and six and seven after that. It's just one, so you have a singular, a plural, a dual, and a plural. And incidentally, the dual is the same as it is in all Indo-European languages. It sounds the same way. And the plural is the same. You'd be surprised. You'd think it was Latin or Greek or something like that here, how much like it they are. Well, anyway, he begot the Ennead, the nine of them, but he says here has no more connection with the number nine, whatever, anymore. That being only something left over from the old Heliopolitan Ennead. And so he continues here. So we have that. And then, this means to gather your family. There's a very interesting Iab, that's not an S, but an E. Iab, there we mentioned in the coffin texts, which are very old, they're 2000 BC. They're the coffin texts of the nobility. Numbers 131 on and 146 especially have to do with the sealing of one's family to oneself in the other world, the gathering of the family. And that's the word they use for gather the family, and for the family too, Iab, it has the same, a gathering, a family gathering, but this means to call together, to assemble. He assembled the council of the gods for a discussion, Wep Enef, and he discussed, or he divided, he discerned. Another interesting word here, Wep, you see that all over the place, Enef, between Henoch, Horus, and Re, between Horus and Set. The fight is between Horus and Set. He's to judge. Notice every time the name Set occurs, somebody has piously rubbed it out, because Set is the opposition. Set is Satan, you see. We don't want him in the picture. So for superstitious reasons, we wipe him out. But the Wep is so interesting. Notice it's always written with the horns, and means open. It's our word. It means brow. Well, what's the Latin word for brow? It's ops. Ops word, optic, the eye, and so forth. And what is, it's the opening out. Of course, our word open, wep, is the same word as open. Open, wep, ops, optic, and we have weapon. Weapon, same thing, means to rise and shine and all the rest of it. But he divide, but it's to divide and make distinction. When you open, you divide. The horns divide and go in opposite directions. It's a division. It's a web. So, well, when you open, what do? You unfold thy portals everlasting. You unfold the portals, you open them up. That's why this web means here, to make a distinction, to set them apart. Well, then we go up to the top here. Ko-en-ef shenet. Rested thinks that means he explained, he laid out in particular, but Sather says it means to forbid, to put an end to. The three balls you see together there always have the meaning of exception, to rule out, to either see to be to explain in detail or to rule out, to say we're not discussing that. It's to eliminate, to explain by elimination. We'll say he eliminated, he forbade their quarreling. Remember, he forbade that there should be any contention among them. sin, and he placed Sagittosaurus on the southern throne in the land in which he was initiated. This is, later on it says, in which he was born, but initiated will do, because that's what it says, in the land in which he was born therein, at the place of Sau, a prehistoric place. And then the other one, Geb, it was now Geb. We mentioned who Geb was. He is the principle of legitimate succession. It's an interesting thing here that Geb it is who puts Horus on the throne of the north, on the B throne, Deseret throne, which is written Deseret B. And Deseret means red land, it means holy. Deseret's the word for holy land, Deseret. Also means red land, it was red rock country and so forth. All these things are mixed up. And but it's Geb who appoints Horus, because Geb is the principle of legitimate patriarchal succession. And I was puzzled the last time, because he should have put Seth in there too, but he doesn't, which is very, maybe significant. The fact that Horus is the only one that has that is legitimate. And then, well, that thing isn't roasting, is it? In the land, in the Northland, this is Mehi, Paul Cargett was who wrote a thing, that Mehi, the word Mehi, like the word Mexico, it means Northland. This Mehi always means Northland, and Mexico means, in the Central American languages, it meant North Country too. Another parallel with Egypt, you get lots of them. At the place where his father was drowned. Now his father goes into the water there, and he emerges from the water to be rescued, to come into a new life, and to mount the throne. Well, obviously, baptism. In fact, that's what Gardner calls it. He wrote a long article in the JEA on the baptism of Pharaoh. That's where he was baptized and renewed. Just the place where he was initiated, the place where his father was baptized. Now, at the division of the lands, Empesh Tawi. Pesh, same word as part, split, and so forth. Empesh Tawi. Then, so a very interesting conjunction here that you only find in very old Egyptian. Then Horus and Set mounted. See, here is an aha, which is a mast, a ladder, a mast on a ship, which you mount. It means mounted up, of course. They both mounted up upon, a face is upon, face, very easy, upon the two thrones of Horus and Set. The Atet. Now, the Atet, that's a very interesting word here that they used it. What it is Yiat. I've talked about this. I talked with Professor Edwards when he was here about this. This is what an Yiat is. If you go through the New Testament, if you go through the pyramid text, you'll find every once in a while a person makes a pilgrimage to the most holy place, and he circumambulates the Yiats, and they usually give, or three of them, always written like this. What it is a mound, of course, surrounded by standing stones, and this is the Yiat, and that's what it says here. Each one has his Yiat, or his ceremonial symbol, which means it goes back to megalithic times, Stone Age, it's very old stuff. Each one has his Yiat, because we know that's what Heliopolis was. Marietta discovered that, it was such a founding. Each had his Yiat here, and it's very interesting that Edwards himself has come to accept that idea as the origin of the pyramid now. Somebody has just written a monograph on the subject, which justifies it. No one had heard it before. He comes to his Yiat. Then, at the division of the lands, and the two lands were pacified and reconciled. This is our old friend Hetep. You always see Hetep all over the place in everybody's name. Was pacified and settled. They pacified and settled the two lands at Eon. Eon means the beautiful place, like Nauvoo, the beautiful place. Yeah, at the Eon, which is the division of the lands. Repeats it again. That Eon, which is the place where the lands are divided. Remember King Lib dividing the land north and the land south. Now we come to this next one, and Geb now speaks to Seth. You can always get Seth because his name has been blacked out. Because his name has been blacked out. And he says these are, now this formula, there's no doubt what that means. These words must be spoken out loud. They must be recited exactly as they are written, and these are to be spoken by the person who is taking the part of Geb, the earth god. Now the goose is purely phonetic, because all these characters are human. Nowhere do you find them in any animal or bird form or anything like that. This is the oldest time, say, it was all human. And he speaks to him and he says, go, Jer, to the place. There's another archaic expression, Jer for two instead of N, or air. To the place where thou wert born. So it's born here, he says, where you were initiated. Here he says where you were born, Mesek, therein where you were born. And here are stage instructions. Set, there's the Set animal, you see, takes his place on the south side of the hall. So this is dramatized that way. Then he says to Horus, you go to the place where your father was buried in the waters, where he was drowned in that place. Horus goes to the north side of the hall. Then he addresses the two of them. See, the two are together. There's both Geb, both Horus and Seth. He says, Wep and Sen, you are divided. Notice there are the dividing horns there. Wep and Sen, I and Esen, I have divided you. The first person you do not write here, the first person after verbs. That's another archaic practice. See, instead of Wep and E, you should have a little person sitting there, but you don't do it at this time. Wep and Echen, I have divided you. I've set you apart. And so they take their places, north and south. And that's it. Now, it continues this way now. Does he go here? Is this Jew first? Is this big argument between Ehrman and Seth about that? But let's go on here. Oh, no, it should go on here, of course. Geb then speaks to the entire assembly of the gods. See, there's the three flags there, the three natural signs of divinity. And he says these words, I have commanded Horus, saying, Choet, you are the Yinip. You are, this is Anubis, pronounced Yinip, but Yinip means successor to the throne, too, the royal imp, you see. This is you are the Yinip, and it can also be Wetu. Wetu also means the same thing. It's related to the word for Wawet here. But you are the successor, he says to him. Geb speaks to the gods again. He, Horus, alone, only Horus, Wawet Horus, only Horus, he is the only heir. You notice the word for heir or inherit is a leg of beef, suet, it's called suet, or iat here, iat. It means, you notice why it's a piece of meat. It goes back to early times. Who gets the biggest piece at the table? You know, in Homer, the quivering chimes of beef, and you compete about the meat of honor. Well, who at the table, who gets the biggest chunk? And this is a quivering chine of beef, you see. And it means it's the word for the iat. They all sound alike, don't they? It means a payment. A reward, often a reward. An heir, an yati here means an heir. See, put a t on the end. He is the heir. So for him will be, he alone receives the inheritance. And then he says to them again, En Pefi, to this one, very emphatically, is given, this one is given the heir. Oh, Enpef, that's the old form, the Enpef, yes, like Entef. He is the heir, and then he says he is, again, he is the only heir, he's the only Wati. He gets the only inheritance, he's the only Wati. And then he says to the God, he's making this known to everybody, you see. I have chosen him, he says here. I have chosen for the son of my son, Horus, to be the, notice here is Wep Wawet. You'll notice on the... under facsimile number 2, that the top figure carries the staff with the dog on top. That's Wep Wawet, who opens the ways. He begins the years, he fights the land. It's the hound, the chess, the hound of the pharaoh, whoever it is, that goes ahead of you in the hunt and smells out the way in front of you, scares up the game, and leads the way. And so Wep Wawet is the one who comes first. Of course, it goes back to hunting culture. And he is the weapon. He is the one who shall be the open of the way. Here it's written out, the Wep Wawet. He is the one who will open the way. But here he is the Wetu. Ehrman would say he means the Wetu. This means the principle of patriarchal succession. He is in that. And he repeats the same thing again here. He says, he is the opener, there's Wep again, you see, of the womb. The firstborn, in other words. This is Khet, it's the belly and udders of a cow. And the Wep Khat is the one who opens. The womb is the firstborn. So he is the firstborn. No, he is my son. He is my firstborn, he says here. Horus, who is Wep Wawet, who opens the way. He will start things. He will establish things on the earth and take over. Then the next one, the final one here, he says, he speaks again to the council of the gods and says, Geb Pel Mesu Em, oh, Sapel, this is my son, Mesu, who is born, who is Horus, and Mes Wepet, who is born at the new year. So it celebrates the new year. It's the beginning of a new age. You see, everything starts out at once, a new life, a new age, a new kingdom, and everything else. We're founding a new kingdom, a new dynasty. What better than to go back to the beginning of all times, the oldest, most stable kingdom in the world, when it was founded, and that's this. So this is founded at the new year. Well, this is the end. This was noticed long ago, this 18 year. Everybody noticed that. This is the end of Act 1. They've been given their appointments, things are settled and so forth. Now what's going to happen? The play has to move now. Oh, so we get to Act 2, and the trouble begins. But we won't have time for any more trouble than we've already had here. So we should be able to finish it the next time, ha ha.